Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is William J. Broad, whose latest book is The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. William J. Broad is a senior science writer for the New York Times. He's the author or co-author of six other books, including The Oracle, Ancient Delphi, and the Science Behind Its Lost Secrets, Teller's War, the top secret story behind the Star Wars deception, also the co-author of a book with, among others, Judith Miller, which talks about germ warfare and touches on Saddam Hussein. I want to talk a little about Judith Miller and the Times and your relationship with that. But let's start first talking about the science of yoga. The first I heard about this book, I'd been sent to an article, I believe it was in the Yoga Journal, which focused on one chapter about the risk of injury in yoga. And in fact, the yoga community appeared to be up in arms over it. And I found it fascinating because when I read the book, most of the book is in favor of yoga, except for the one chapter.
Yeah. It's all about benefits, hidden benefits, good things. But there is also surprising downsides, which I think people ought to be aware of. But it was a shock to many because they're used to this idea that yoga is perfect. There's this mystique of perfection. You put your knee down on a yoga mat and somehow you've entered on this path of spirituality. So it's seldom that, you know, hard scientific evidence gets brought into that arena and people start saying, well, if you're not careful, you're going to cripple yourself badly or maybe even kill yourself. Who knows how often that happens, but it is a risk that's out there. So those are rare things. The benefits are common. And they are astonishing. I've been practicing yoga since 1970, and I had no idea about a lot of this stuff. It's interesting.
Well, for me, I have never practiced yoga.
God bless you.
I was saying before we went on the air that the one time I have a friend years ago who was a big yoga practitioner, and she said, okay, let's start. Go into the full lotus. And when my knee went one way and my body went the other, I said, okay, I'll do something else instead. And I pretty much stayed away from yoga. Part of it, which you touch on in this book, is that there's no higher authority here. And in a way, you're pretty much on your own if you want to go and look for a yoga teacher or kind of yoga.
Right. It's the Wild West out there. Anybody who wants to can put out a shingle, get a teacher certification, and presto chango, go down this path of being a teacher. Some of them are excellent. Some of them are super knowledgeable. Others are very green, and it can be dangerous to work with them because they have this idea that you should achieve this ideal pose rather than tailoring your body, you know, shaping you to the pose, because we're all individuals, and you need to take individual idiosyncrasies into an individual place where you are on this path into consideration before you start trying to go for a full lotus or something.
My friend got it wrong before we even began.
Immediately. They were trying to push you, you know, tailor your body to this idealized, you know, condition, which is wrong. You should start where the student is rather than starting where the teacher thinks you ought to be.
And a yoga teacher, if I decide to take a week of classes and say, hey, I'm a yoga teacher, nobody can stop me and there's no accreditation.
Well, there are schools and there are types of accreditation, but anybody who wants to can teach, and they do. There is a group called the Yoga Alliance. They have a minimum requirement. They will register you if you've had 200 hours of training. But 200 hours, I mean, would you trust a car mechanic that had 200 hours training or a violin teacher or a brain surgeon? I mean, it's not a lot. There are higher levels of accreditation. There are schools out there, many that do a very good job. The Iyengar teachers go through a minimum of 2 years of training. That's a lot. And they're very good on using props, using blocks and blankets to try to help your body to be sensitive to the individual idiosyncrasies that we all have rather than trying to force you into one of these idealized poses. So there's a whole spectrum, and it goes from the Wild West to the very sophisticated.
and yoga therapists. There's a group called the RYT, but again, we're coming back to the idea that pretty much anybody could say, hey, look at
me.
Yeah,
registered yoga therapist is a fiction. There is no such thing, and yet a lot of people claim it, and it looks really good after your name, and it sounds really good. Registered yoga therapy, I mean, whoa, it sounds professional, but no, we're back in the Wild West on that again. Although, you know, in the book, we talk about people who are great therapists who can do astonishing things. This guy I profile at the top of the healing chapter, Lauren Fishman, is a medical doctor who also does yoga therapy. He came up with what really is a miracle cure for rotator cuff injuries, you know, serious, bad, hard to live with thing, expensive surgery, all that. A modified, simple headstand can teach you how to do muscle substitution, so the rotator cuff injury goes away. He's done that with more than 1,000 patients now. So it's one of these quirky, wonderful yoga cure things that are real.
A little sidelight there. I'm a big baseball fan. Do you know if he's actually talked to rotator cuff injury pitchers?
Sports people, yes, definitely. A number of them. They come in and they are just delighted. He did this to himself. He's a yoga nutcake. He's out there, even though he's got a torn rotator cuff, he's in a headstand and he gets up and all of a sudden, lo and behold, he can lift his arm to his shock and delight. So he investigated, he developed a method that he's using with his patients. My colleague at the New York Times, Jane Brody, wrote about it in one of her columns and started getting letters back from all kinds of people who started doing it, and presto changeo, the problem is fixed. So why not? It's easy, it's basically free. Why spend thousands of dollars for discomfort and surgery?
I want to get back to that basically free point in a bit, but let's go back to the book, The Science of Yoga, William J. Broad. You know, you're a science writer. You've been doing this yoga since 1970. You've won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes.
Shared a couple, let's be fair, okay?
Okay.
With my colleagues, okay? I'm going to get nasty letters if we don't be real clear.
Okay, well, you know, 2006 comes along, and someone asked you what triggered the book, and your response was, the tougher question is, what took so long to write a book about the science of yoga?
Right.
But seriously, what triggered you? What made you say, okay, I'm a science writer for the Times. I've written about all of these other things.
Right.
I've won awards. Why now?
Why now? Well, it was opportunity. I had spent too much of my career worrying about weapons of mass destruction, germ weapons, nukes, Star Wars, all these nasty, crazy things that the military-industrial complex was pushing and oftentimes struck me as dangerous. You know, the Cold War ended, and I started to have this, what I saw as a personal opportunity to diversify and do fun things. I wrote a book about the deep sea. I wrote a book about the Oracle of Delphi. And I was thinking, you know, back in that 2005-06 time frame, and I'd been doing more and more biology, which was an early love of mine in college, and it was literally a light bulb moment, like, oh, yeah. I could write about yoga and use all my skills as a science journalist to explore this thing that I do, that I've had questions about for decades, and answer my own questions, learn a bunch of stuff, and write a book. I thought it was going to be quick and easy. It wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Were you standing on your head at the time?
No, but I do find yoga inspiring. It turns out to be the last chapter of the book, the Muse chapter. There is an inspirational and a creative element in this that science has started to document.
Well, it's obvious in the book that it was a struggle to get any information anywhere and to go through these sources. Mm. Do you think in that sense yoga helped you come up with ideas?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. When I do my routine every day, I keep pencil and paper nearby. I find that creative ideas bubble up. I'm fresher. New thought comes. You know, this book was written in part because I was doing yoga and because this, you know, creative process was ongoing. I experience it myself, and there's interesting science, preliminary studies for sure, but still tantalizing and interesting, saying that yoga lights up the right brain of the bicameral mind, the cerebral hemispheres, and that's the side associated with spatial relationships, creativity, all that kind of good stuff. The left side is the linear, speech, mathematics, all that. So you light up the right side, this intuitive, creative side. The left side chatterbox, which is that little voice that's always driving you crazy about the appointment you have coming up or the project that needs to get done, that quiets down, you get centered, and oftentimes, and for me, and I think a lot of people, fun things bubble up. Maureen Dowd was the first journalist to write about this book. She did it in October when she got her hands on some galleys. And she came out of the closet. She said, yoga is the one thing that I found that lets me unwind, that really lets me relax. Well, I've got to believe that it does more than that. Maureen, as you know, is an incredible, creative, interesting human being. She's knocking out these columns three times a week on all kinds of subjects. She's got energy. She's got artistry. She's got this wonderful edginess about her. I think yoga's helping her in many ways.
When I think of yoga, I think of, oh, my God, you got to learn 15 or 20 poses. But mm-hmm. then you say, well, no, if you want to relax, use the corpse. Mm-hmm. If you want to build up your sex, use, I don't remember the name of it, but you kind of lift yourself.
The cobra, right. The cobra has, the science couldn't be clearer. These guys studied it very carefully. They looked at this individual pose. You know, you're laying down, you push up with your arms so that your head is up, your abdomen is up, and all the pressure is going down on your pelvis. And they've, you know, did blood samples, and there's couldn't be clearer. Testosterone levels go up. Testosterone is an arousing hormone, sexually arousing hormone in men and for women. You know, the levels are much smaller, but it's critical for female arousal. You don't have those circulating levels of testosterone, you're not going to become aroused. The science couldn't be clearer, and you can see it in brain scans. You can see it in all kinds of ways. There was a neat guy, my friend Vikas in New Delhi, who did a study of 100 people, women and men, married couples who took up yoga, and they did questionnaires before and questionnaires after. And let me tell you, you had a lot of people testifying to sexual revitalization. It helped in their sex lives.
It turns out, as you've said, that this wasn't surprising once you looked into the history, because yoga derives
from... To my surprise, yeah, right. It goes way back into all kinds of early primal sexual practices in early India.
How much of the history of yoga did you actually know? I mean, you've been practicing it for 35 years at the time, but how much did you really know going in?
Not much. I mean, when I had picked this up at first, my friends and I back, you know, freshman year of college, sophomore year of college, when we started getting into it, I did some reading, but not like I did once I started research on the book. I got a master's in the history of science at the University of Wisconsin. I had embarked on a PhD, which I never got. But I'm a history buff. I love that stuff. So immediately I wanted to know, what is yoga? Where does yoga come from? I have to inform myself if I'm going to write a book about this subject. To me, it was surprising, because it turns out that hatha, the kind of practice that everybody does around the planet now with all these postures, started out, had its roots back in this misty era of sexual yoga. And I've gotten a lot of pushback on that when I say it. I'm talking about sexual in a cosmic sense. A lot of times you know, it's this cosmic duality. You call it the yin and the yang, or whatever you want. In the Hindu religion, oftentimes it's Shiva and Shakti, right? This cosmic duality, which you are going to do away with and achieve this oneness. So most of it probably, you know, has to do with something other than physical sex. But it turns out, you go back to the early Hatha textbooks from, you know, the 1400s, and they're talking about intercourse, or slamming your genitals on the ground over and over, doing all these things that clearly have to do with sexual arousal. I mean, that was part of the shtick. They also, you know, talk about poses, but oftentimes they're sitting poses where you are, you know, pressing your pelvis or doing things, or, you know, using the heel of your foot to press your perineum. That's the place on your body between the genitals and your anus. It is extremely sensitive for erotic stimulation. And, you know, it's clear that this had to do with trying to raise your level of physiological arousal on this path to spiritual enlightenment, on this path, you know, which is often described as bliss. Right? Achieve this blissful oneness.
When you were organizing the book, were there any chapters that emerged from your research as opposed to the original outline?
Yes, with this creativity one. I couldn't believe it, you know, that there is all this evidence that yoga actually stirs this, you know, the creative metabolism. Also, one of the big myths to fall was the idea that yoga is the only thing you need to do. Yoga is the one exercise that will do everything, that the cardiovascular benefits are so great. Your heart, the cardio exercise, is so powerful that you don't need to think about aerobic exercise. That's a big claim, and it was surprising to me how clear the answer was. The sports establishment had thrown a lot of money at this question, looked at it carefully, and said no. There were studies done in Texas, studies done in Wisconsin, studies done in New York, and it couldn't be clearer. No matter how fast you go in your style of yoga, there's some Ashtanga or styles where you do a lot of sun salutations, you're really whipping back and forth. No matter how hard, how fast, you can't, or at least according to these studies, you can't achieve that pounding heartbeat that you need to get the aerobic benefits that public health officials call the number one thing for health. You know, you got to get that heart going really fast.
And it slows metabolism.
It's slow, right. What it does do, dispositively, and much of this stuff was surprising to me, and this also has, like much in yoga, it has an upside and a downside. The slowing the metabolism is a great thing for cardiovascular stuff again. Not because it goes so fast, but because it goes low. Because it fights high blood pressure. Because it fights hypertension. Because it lets your body slow down, and that can be extremely beneficial. The bummer is that yoga is often sold as a magic pill for losing weight. The scientific truth is that if everything else is equal, if you eat the same number of calories every day and take up yoga, your metabolism will slow down and you will gain weight. It's mathematical. You can't avoid it. That's what's happening metabolically. Now, in real life, people get lots of other things from yoga. A lot of times they get discipline. A lot of times they get de-stressed so that it's easy to break the stress eating cycle. Instead of having an ice cream cone or a candy bar, I'm just not that freaked out about it. I'm not worried about it. I can, you know, skip that. So the result is often that most people who do yoga, or especially yoga teachers who are also burning a lot of calories if they teach a lot, are alive. They're not lumpy. But that's despite what's going on with your metabolism, not because. And this is so oversold in books and on the internet, everywhere else. You know, magic weight loss formula, buy it today. You know, the title of a book, a recent book that came out in 2010 with Tara Stiles, a wonderful, talented yoga teacher. I'm going to do a program with her this week in New York. But, the first thing in the book, slim. Slim, calm, sexy yoga.
Are you going to hit her up with that question? You know, if you're talking to people in the industry who have radio and television shows and you've debunked their claims in your book, I mean, how far are you willing to go as a reporter?
Well, I talk about this stuff all the time. It's in the book. Anybody who's interested, I'll talk about it. I mean, the science speaks pretty loudly to some of these issues. On the other hand, there's many issues that the science doesn't address. There's ambiguities out there. My metaphor that I use a lot is like yoga is a big cave, and science is a little flashlight or a laser pointer even. You know, it lights up little things here and there, but, you know, there's many aspects of this practice, especially the higher spiritual issues. You know, I mean, science isn't going to get close to that. Who knows?
What was the hardest thing for you to research?
The sex stuff, because unlike, for instance, we were just talking about the aerobic issues, you know, the whole sports establishment had come out and looked at that real hard. On the sex issue, there wasn't so much research. It was contradictory. For instance, there were many studies that said, not many, several, that said doing yoga will lower your testosterone levels. For the longest time, I'd read that and I'd go, oy, 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 vey, I don't want any part of this. I'm just going to put it aside and do something that's clearer and easier. Because it was clear to me, intuitively, that yoga does stir you on hormonal levels. It also made sense historically. This whole practice had started with all kinds of, you know, sexual arousal, or that was at least a, you know, significant part of it. So what's wrong here? And it took years of thinking about this and coming back to it over and over until it started to become clear. Many of these studies had been done. The people weren't just doing yoga. They were also vegetarians. vegetarianism, it turns out, will lower those hormones, right? So you had to disarticulate, you had to break some of this stuff out into the different areas before you could see what the real effects were and what the conflating effects were. Once you get it, it falls into place and it becomes really clear.
But it turns out, of course, if you're going to really do a scientific survey, which a couple of people did, you have to stick with one pose and a control group, because otherwise you never know what two poses are going to do.
No. Right. You do that. And they had done that in the sexual area, and it was very clear. But all this is just, you know, the beginning stages. The earliest paper and the earliest study I found started in 1851. That's really the beginning gong for the science of yoga, this guy in India. So it's been going on for a century and a half, people looking, you know, in all kinds of areas. But still, given the importance of the subject, because I am a yoga booster and think that this stuff is great, there's going to be more and more science in the decades and the centuries ahead, really, because there are big questions, big interesting questions lurking in this field, and some sexual, some having to do with longevity, some having to do with how low you can go. That first chapter that you read starts with this guy who goes through a 40-day burial, day and night. Was that real? Was that magic? Was he, you know, fooling people? Can you shut down your body, basically, and go into these extended states of suspended animation? Science hasn't been wrestling with that, and I think it might have some interesting work cut out for it in the years ahead.
What kind of resistance did you get from people in yoga?
It wasn't, you know, yoga people per se. I was talking to, you know, science people, right. Science of yoga people, and they were all just like, oh, goody, goody. I mean, they were like so happy that somebody was finally getting interested in their work, and especially the Indians. There were many Indian physicians and scientists who had been doing this stuff for a long time, and basically the world had ignored them. And in fact, they had a bad reputation. It was like, oh, yoga science done in India? Oh, please, don't bother me. And it turns out that they were pioneering in many respects. They addressed some fundamental questions that still are, you know, coming up with outstanding answers that many people goof up today and have pioneered all kinds of stuff. So the reaction of the community that's, you know, that was doing the research, doing the studies, all that stuff, they were delighted. They were happy to have somebody interested, talking, asking a lot of questions, and really, you know, turning this into English for the first time.
Well, William J. Broad, what about the people inside yoga who've been promoting all of this, and suddenly people get strokes?
Right. Surprise. Yeah, the people who are promoting yoga as a magic pill, this was bad news for them. And they don't like it. It was interesting when the book first went up on Amazon. You know, there were like instantly a lot of one-star reviews. You can't do any lower. The people obviously hadn't read the book. They hadn't had time to read the book. But they were going to weigh in anyways because it was bad news, right?
The Yoga Journal chapter is the one on injuries.
Injuries. It was actually excerpted of the New York Times magazine. And that got huge currency under a headline which I had never seen. The print headline was "All Bent Out of Shape." The one that went out on the internet was "How Yoga Can Wreck Your Body," which is much more edgy and got the attention of a lot of people. And there was a Twitter storm. I mean, there was a columnist at the Chicago Tribune observed that the boomers and the yuppies had gone through Iraq and, you know, and they had gone through Afghanistan. But when people started messing around with yoga, whoa, then they really, you know, it was war, baby.
Well, I think, William J. Broad, that the reason why a lot of people got scared is there is that chapter on injuries.
Well, but the thing is that the downsides, the hidden dangers, are rare. We don't even know how rare because there's no epidemiology out there that can study it. It takes a lot of money to do, you know, what's the frequency? But we know they're extremely rare. The benefits, on the other hand, are extremely common. Most everybody that does this stuff gets the centering, gets the disconnectedness, lowers their heart rate, you know, gets these cardio benefits. And studies at Harvard and Boston University, no small institutions, show that doing yoga releases these neurotransmitters called GABA, powerful antidepressants. I mean, it's down, hardwired, you know, getting in there into your brain. You know, yoga is making the sunshine come out. Those are common benefits, right? So everybody can get those. It's just every once in a while, unless you're careful, you can be bit really hard.
You mentioned longevity.
Yeah. To me, it was very surprising because, you know, myth-busting journalist, I'm going to go in there and kind of see what's real and what's not. And I figured that was going to be one of the myths because you see it in the literature. You know, Yogi lives to 100, 200, 300 years, some of them. Marco Polo goes to India. First thing he talks about is Yogi's 200 years old. You know, so you figure, oh, this is going to, you know, fall flat on its face. Well, the scientific evidence suggests that there is a considerable truth to it. They have done good studies with control groups showing that yoga fights spinal deterioration. It's sort of logical. All this bending back and forth keeps your spine younger, less deterioration than non-yogis. The real mind-blowing thing is that there is cutting-edge evidence that the clock in the individual cells in the human body, it's called a telomere. It's a little thing at the end of the chromosomes that determine how long that cell is going to live. One of the things that erodes the telomeres and turns that clock forward fast is stress. What is one of the main things that yoga does? De-stresses you. So the logical question is that measurable? Yes. And these were studies done at the University of California, San Francisco. One of the co-authors on this paper is Elizabeth Blackman, who just shared the Nobel Prize for work on telomeres, which is the name for these little things on the end of the chromosomes. And the preliminary news is that yoga releases telomerase, an enzyme that rebuilds these little things. So it looks like yoga works at a cellular level to slow aging and maybe has the possibility of even reversing it. So, I mean, talk about fountain of youth. It was like, it's sort of mind-boggling. But on the other hand, when I'd go around and interview people who'd been, and most of these yoga scientists are also yogis, they're doing this practice, they tended to look, you know, 10, 20, even 30 years younger than their chronological years. I'm 104. I don't look that old, do I? Right? I mean, you know. But they do look younger. They tend to not act their age. Mel Robin, this wonderful guy I studied with in Pennsylvania, I call him the Einstein of yoga because he's written some very fundamental textbooks that go into a lot of the basic science. When I studied with him, I started studying in 2007, he was, I believe, 76. He's rolling around the floor of that studio with, you know, a lot of women and teachers who are in their 20s and 30s. He's not acting his age. He's not acting like he's old and stiff. He's acting like a 30 or 40-year-old. And that happens. I mean, everybody knows old people who, you know, who achieve that, right? But it seems like yoga is a ticket that more or less guarantees that you can move in that direction.
You know, if someone, let's say, doesn't have a lot of money, they're kind of caught up on time because mm-hmm. they're raising kids and working their right. ass off, and right. they're living in America today.
Right.
You know, and this seems to be a lifestyle of the affluent.
Right, the affluent and the educated. I mean, that's, you know, the first line of the book. That's who tends to do this. I think, in my naivete, that that is a mistake, right? I see this as going mainstream. And just take the gray tsunami, right? The aging boomers and the whole world that's aging. What is getting old? To a large extent, it is getting stiff, and oftentimes you lose your sense of balance. You fall over, you break your hip, you end up in the hospital, you catch a nasty infection, and you're dead. You know, yoga addresses both those things. The studies couldn't be clearer. Your balance gets better. You will become more flexible. You know, just on that score alone, every old age home, every assisted living facility, every nursing home should be teaching gentle yoga. It's a no-brainer. It's going to improve the quality of life. And it's also social. You get into those classes and you laugh at each other because, you know, I've been doing yoga 42 years. I cannot touch my toes. I mean, it's silly and, you know, I get into a class and people giggle. I'm stiff. What can I say? I work for what little flexibility I can get. And it's just a naturally fun social thing to do, and the long-term health benefits are pretty good. But the economics, you know, I'm not spending money on yoga. Actually, the classes that I originally took in 1970 were free.
And what about today?
I do my own routine every morning. I did it at the hotel this morning. I'll do it for free tomorrow. I'm not spending money on yoga.
Are there a lot of free classes around?
They actually, the Yoga Health Foundation, which is based in California, has something that's organized called Yoga Month. Every September, you will be able to do a week's worth of free yoga classes. They want to get you hooked, and they want to get you going into studios. My thing is, why spend a lot of money? Why do all these competitive styles? Why not do old, simple yoga, which is, you know, learn some poses, learn how to tailor it to your own body. Do it on your own. Do a little every day. Do a little stretching. Do a little centering. You know, use it as, an adjunct maybe to a cup of coffee or whatever you do to start the day. And don't spend a lot of money. Don't, you know, fork over big bills to the yoga industrial complex. I mean, those people are very creative, maybe partially because they do a lot of yoga, you know, coming up with clever ways to do expensive marketing. I mean, every aspect of American society does that. Pills, you know, Viagra, you know, all the little blue pills. Come on. You can do it with a yoga pose for free. Cobra, that's it. Get thee to a yoga studio, learn how to do Cobra right, and you're sailing.
When you're talking like this, I mean, there's all of these different kinds of yoga. You're basically saying that if you really don't want to bother with specific types, just learn a few poses for free and do them on your own and screw the rest, pretty much?
Well, that's kind of what I do. That's a pretty good description of my routine. I have, over the years, I have a very eclectic style. I do the things that I like and that I find work for me. Also, in my research, I discovered that, hey, the risks associated with shoulder stand and plow position, I don't want any part of it, no matter how low the risk is. I don't want a stroke, thank you. And clearly the medical literature says in some rare cases you can have a stroke. So that's fine. I don't want to do those poses.
There's one bending one that's particularly bad too, right?
I did in this class with this Einstein of Yoga guy in Pennsylvania. It was filled with all these lovely, you know, 30-something flexible, beautiful yoga teachers, women. And we partnered off, and my partner did the extended side angle, which is not that hard of a pose, but you're bending way over. And then it was my turn, and I was, you know, kind of feeling good and wanted to kind of show off a little bit, and she was gorgeous, and I was paying attention to her, and just, you know, had this horrific bad day at the yoga studio when my lower back went out. You know, my eyes watered up, and my knees gave way, and I slammed into a wall and lay in a pile on the floor for a while. And it took a couple months before I was back in shape. So that was my own fault, right? I'm not going to blame it on Mel Robin, who was the teacher that day. I should have been aware of that limitation that I knew about. I've got a injured lower back, a herniated L4, L5 vertebrae, vertebral disc in there. And there was no way I should have been doing that pose without paying very, very close attention to my lower back. I blew it. But now, you know, I know some of my limitations. I know the poses. I do it every day and have a good time.
When you're going into a pose and you start feeling pain, does that mean you stop? I mean, how do you?
I'm a wimp. I mean, I don't like pain. I mean, some of these people say, don't you feel like you have to be challenged? And I go, no, not really. I like gentle yoga. And you know what, too? I think of this as old yoga. And actually, I've learned this a lot through my research. When I do my little fuddy-duddy routine, I close my eyes. I focus on my body, and I'm paying attention to all of those sensations, and I'm visualizing where my arm is and my fingers are and what it is I'm doing. And I find when I do that, I'm closing out the world. The left brain is shutting down. The right brain is picking up and is doing all this gestalt focusing on all these sensory things that are coming in. And thresholds of pain, forget it. I would rather do this, you know, gentle, calm, meditative routine that I find to be enormously relaxing, enormously centering, and I think helps me be an excellent journalist. It gives me the energy and the freshness to get back in the grind and give it everything I got.
February 27th, you wrote a piece in the Times about John Friend, the founder of Anusara, who was having several affairs. And, you know, you mentioned it in the book, The Science of Yoga, about how very creative people sometimes have very creative appetites. But, you know, I kept thinking, why is anybody even upset that he's screwing around?
Consensual sex, right, big deal. Here's why it is a big deal. Because with priests, with rabbis, with counselors, with psychologists, psychoanalysts. There is this authority issue. And it's there with yoga teachers and it's there with gurus. You know, the student invests these people with power. And I'm no specialist on this, but all the specialists say, you know, this is an issue of ethics. There's a power imbalance, and you have to be sensitive to it, which means you don't mess around with your students. Now, this is a big ha-ha line because every yoga teacher, and, you know, especially in California, I mean, it's like, what? Gambling in the casino? I'm shocked. Shocked. I mean, it happens all the time. And it's if it's consensual sex, I mean, you know, God bless it and why not? The problem is that a lot of times, and maybe this was more in the old days when the gurus were up on a little higher pedestal, people basically viewed these as people as gods. And when they let go and gave themselves to these people, they really gave. And then when the guru would move on to the next, you know, student, they were devastated. And I've talked to some of these people. And, you know, in their 50s, they are still working through the trauma that they experienced in their 20s. So there can be lasting psychological damage. There are marriages that have come under, you know, enormous stress in these circumstances. There is, you know, a lot of long-term damage that can be associated with it. But, you know, the upside is a lot of these philandering gurus, 60s, 70s. I mean, you know, another party wants to say, yeah, baby, go for it. Yeah. I mean, God bless. And, you know, we all should be so vibrant.
William J. Broad, as a science writer for the New York Times, right, what is your take on climate change deniers and the Republican war on science?
Oh, it's a big, hairy, complex issue. The science of climate change is one of the most complex sciences there is. And I think there's room in there for deniers. I don't want to get into the politics of this, which I think are enormously huge, complex, and hard to understand. But one thing people don't understand in terms of the science is that a simple science problem might have two or three variables. Climate change, you know, has many, many more variables, and it's a much harder thing to crack. There's no question that the globe is getting warmer and that, you know, evidence is strong that some component of that has to do with CO2 and our industrial madness and all that stuff. But it is a complex scientific problem, and people who turn it into just a cartoon, I think, are doing us a disservice. There are real hard scientific debates going into this, and I don't think it's as easy as deniers and people who are confronting it. There's a lot of grays in there.
At the same time, the deniers are being paid off by the oil industry.
They are in some cases, but there's also the academic, you know, complex that, I mean, there's big money involved in climate science, too, and it's not oil money, right? But there are, you know, there are big grants, and there are big reputations at stake. There's all kinds of money in this game on both sides, which is, you know, too bad because in this money war and in this debate, I think, you know, the science gets fuzzed up enormously. These are real, hard, really obviously huge, serious issues that I fear too often get turned into cartoons.
Well, they get turned into cartoons because they're becoming political footballs.
Right, exactly, exactly. It all gets politicized, and it's not, but then it's not science anymore, it's politics.
But, you know, from what I've read, 98% of scientists will go along and say it's climate change. I mean, how big does it have to get?
Well, I don't think anybody in their right mind, it doesn't have to be a scientist, it's anybody, right, can feel that things are changing. The hard question is why? Because this planet is 4.5 billion years old. There has never, ever in the history of this planet been a period of climate stability. You know, things are always changing. So the question, the very, very hard scientific question is, to what degree is the pace of change being influenced by us? Because it would be changing anyways. The oceans have never, in the last few millions of years, they have never been so low. The oceans are going to rise. We are at a historic low point in terms of the overall oceans. They are going to rise. Now, are they rising faster than they would have normally? Probably to some extent. How much faster? That's a really hard scientific question because you can't do experiments in time. It's very difficult to do. It's a historical thing. It's rooted in history, so it's very hard to tease out the factors. You can do it, but it's a real hard science.
But you've also got the destruction of the coral reefs. Is that, again, just simply...
No, there's all kinds of stuff happening, and some of it's cyclic, probably. Some of it is heat-related and the acidification of the ocean. I've written this book, The Universe Below, so you're talking to a fish, basically, who loves, the ocean and all this stuff. And you see coral reefs being, ruined. Some of that has to do not with temperature change, but the breakup of the predator chain. It turns out that if you take off the top-level predators, including sharks, which we are killing, in mass, they are, many shark species are threatened by predation, human predation. There's this phenomena that the way, way, way down lower on the food chain also gets affected, and the whole coral reef ecology gets bollocksed. It's one of these, so many variables in the ocean, right, including climate change, including CO2 levels, which change the acidity of the ocean, including huge, huge predation and overfishing, which is starting to be addressed but still is a global crisis, especially as the human population keeps spiking upward. So lots of room for good science, lots of variables, and obviously a very important thing to pay attention to.
William J. Broad, it says in these articles, contributing to this article is
right,
William J. Broad. So when I see something like, for instance, North Korea says it will launch a satellite, or Iran pressed to give nuclear inspectors full access, what exactly are you doing articles?
I am the techie. I am the guy who basically knows how to build an atom bomb or can put together a rocket if he had to. Somewhere, I don't know why, right? Mr. Death and Destruction has, picked up this skill set. I've spent a lot of time at Los Alamos in the mountains of New Mexico. I've spent a lot of time at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory out in the valley there. I know these people. I know how they work, and I know their technology. So I'm kind of the guy that goes in and helps other reporters who may not have the technical background to help them know the difference between a rocket and a missile and what it means and how hard or easy is this technology. Should we be worried about the Iranians? Does the fact that North Korea can launch a big missile mean that they're going to be able to drop bombs on New York or Los Angeles next thing? I'm the techie guy who can help.
So when there's an article that says, say, from 2003, you and Judith Miller, that she called you up and said, what is this stuff?
No, it was oftentimes editors saying, Bill Broad, we trust Bill Broad to have a certain level of technical know-how to help other reporters winnow and sift through these very complex technical and scientific issues. I would often be the technical helper. I helped Judy on many occasions, and as you know, we wrote a book together, Germs, which was a number one New York Times bestseller after 9/11. The science is enormously complex. It's biology. It can be very messy, and sometimes things go and sometimes they don't. It's easy to hype it, especially germ warfare and that kind of stuff. It's one of these low-level things you ought to, it's good to keep your eye on because the consequences can be very high. It's just like yoga injuries. The chance of having a stroke is very low, but if it happens, you've had a bad day.
Were you snowed under by the rush to war, like people like Gail Collins?
You mean for Iraq?
Yeah.
I was skeptical, and one of the things I, kick myself in the butt today is that I didn't articulate my skepticism more strongly. I didn't really have the cards and the reporting and the chops to be able to go say, something's wrong here, this doesn't add up, right, the evidence that we have. And also, I have developed a good relationship with the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. And they were the people before Iraq who were saying, we've been there, we've looked around, we don't see these things that you are reporting, and we don't think there is a cause. We don't find any evidence that Saddam has reconstituted his nuclear weapons program. That, in retrospect, turned out to be a righteous judgment that a lot of people, including some people at the New York Times, should have paid really close attention to.
William J. Broad, in Science of Yoga, two questions. What could you not find out that you were looking for? And the second is, if you were writing it after all the criticisms came in, what would you have added?
Oh, two great questions. Yikes. Well, the things I couldn't find, a lot of the science points to extreme states of human existence where there are no answers, but there's a lot of tantalizing stuff. They basically go to how low can you go physiologically? Can you turn yourself off, basically? You know, go into states of suspended animation. Is that physiologically possible? The science doesn't address it. And I think there are gifted individuals out there who may be able to do that. I would like to study them, or I wish somebody in a position to do that would do that. Another side of that coin is how high can you go? Physiologically, can people go into heightened states of sexual experience? You know, long orgasms, call it whatever you want, but where you are just, you know, taking off into areas of maybe spirituality or human experience, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. The science suggests that those things are real. There are people at Rutgers University who are looking at women who, they call it thinking off. Their brains light up just like, you know, people, lovers, who light up their brains, except they're not doing anything except thinking. So those are, to me, scientific mysteries that are juicy and just waiting to be explored. Your other question about kind of what would I do differently or how would I address the critics and all that stuff, I have gotten so much positive feedback from this book. Letters that make you want to cry. Letters of, you know, insiders, people in the community who know exactly what's gone down, who know the risks, who've lived through the risks and put themselves together, or who know the joys and the subtleties. I mean, I could write an encyclopedia at this point because I've gotten a lot of interesting feedback. Iyengar is a founder of modern yoga. His book, Light on Yoga, was published in 1965. One of his right-hand people who started with Iyengar before Light on Yoga was written, you know, we're now deep in a correspondence, you know, back and forth. How did yoga evolve? What did we learn? What were the injuries? The Iyengar school now is pioneering all kinds of ways to try to reduce injuries, introduce props, blankets, blocks that are trying to tailor the pose to your body rather than tailoring your body to the pose. Smart stuff. How did that happen? If I was going to do it all again, I would pack it full of all, you know, the reformers, the people who are out there producing better yoga. That's the bottom line of the book. You know, look at this information. Help, you know, learn how to become your own best teacher and produce a better yoga for you.
Is there a website that anybody around the country could go to find out about simple yoga that doesn't cost anything?
That's a great question. I don't think I can answer that. Because I know more about the science of yoga than about all the styles and what's out there. The front of the book does list 13 different styles and gives a very brief, I'm very proud of it. It's a very concise description of the different styles. And in there you can see what's easy, what's challenging, what's, you know, maybe, you know, you don't want to look at and things that you might. You could use that. There's this free yoga every September. Every studio does it, I think, or most studios participate. There are DVDs. The problem with doing it online and all that kind of stuff is that experience means a lot. It's like location, location, location in real estate. You know, the more experience the teacher, the better. You know, you can even do, you know, simple books. And if you're gentle with yourself and you don't try to, you know, push it and get into these, you know, looking like the model on the cover of Yoga Journal frame of mind, I think you can even do a lot of self-instruction. You know, just get a good book and go gently. But there's nothing like having a good teacher.
William J. Broad, what are you working on now?
I'm working on getting through this, surviving this book. I've got some ideas for future ones. But, you know, as they say in the business, we're taking this one step at a time.
You plan to do anything with James Cameron now? You've written a couple articles.
Oh, he's just endlessly fascinating. I've spoken with him about 4 or 5 times. He's doing all this cutting-edge technology, and I applaud it because governments are wimping out right and left, and he's going where, you know, boldly where no government, you know, goes in terms of developing deep-sea exploratory technology. I think it's enormously cool, and I applaud him for doing it. He did this one dive down there, didn't come up with much, but he's opening a door, and there is going to be cool stuff that people find in the future down there. And clearly, the scientists are just, you know, over the moon. They love this.
Have you been to the Titanic?
Personally?
Yeah.
I went on a Titanic voyage. I didn't go down in a submersible, but I was up there swimming around in the water, and down 2.5 miles below me was the wreck. It was a little bit spooky. We're coming up on the 100th, and I'm working on a Titanic article right now, which is interesting stuff, and I'll appear in the science section of the New York Times, I think, on April 10th. So that's everywhere and is interesting, the technology and the science. I got the best job in the world. This is a lot of fun issues, a lot of good science, and it's, unlike a lot of things, it's progressive. Science is moving forward, and it's moving us into interesting areas, so it's a great, fun job.
You've been listening to an interview with William J. Broad, whose latest book is The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.